Okay. You know, Lisa Fine has the record currently for the amount of presentations that she's done in the 17 years of the Our Daily Work, Our Daily Live Brown Bag series. Now, but the reason that we keep on asking her is she keeps on doing unbelievably important research. And the current research that she's doing could not be more timely in a number of different ways. So that the constant kind of debate about jobs versus environment, jobs versus other social goods, these debates go on constantly in the history of the United States and elsewhere. Now, the important thing about today's topic is that you're really going to hear Lisa talk about the fact that at times it ends up being a discussion between groups of workers rather than simply between environmentalists on the one side and labor on the other. So hers is a much more nuanced and textured story. So we're really, really looking forward to Lisa's presentation. Lisa is a professor of history here at Michigan State University and is most noted locally. I think she's a local heroine for the fact that she did the unbelievably fundamental and important work on the Rio workers of Lansing, which was a great piece of research. She also co-directs the Center for Global Context. But all of us know it on campus as GenCEN, and that's an extremely important institution in both our global reach here at Michigan State University, but also the primacy of the study of women in relation to what we do here at MSU. So today, Lisa will be speaking on Exploring Power and Place, the Enrico Fermi Atomic Energy Plant and the Workers of Downriver, Detroit. So please help me in welcoming Lisa Fine.
Thank you, John. This is broadcasting. Is this too loud? No, it's good? Okay. Sounds loud to me. I want to thank John for two things this time around, although I always have something to thank him for. One is for helping me come up with a title, and secondly for allowing me this opportunity to present which is some very tentative work. This is something that I've just started. It's part of a new project, and you need to be aware that it hasn't before this seen the light of day, so I'm very anxious to hear what you all have to say about it, directions that I might take it, things that I need to elaborate on, fix. And also you need to know that I'm a labor historian, which is why I'm giving this presentation, and there's a lot of science involved with this, which I am completely and utterly, you know, unequipped to deal with, since I never even took a physics class in my entire life. So you need to be aware of that as well, that I'm in very tentative waters here for me to be operating in. So I have a prepared talk, which is a shorter version of an article that I'm working on. I've tried it. It's about 35 minutes or so, and so hopefully there'll be an opportunity for you to give me some feedback on this, which I feel like I sorely need at this point. I've been working on it for about a year now. So let me start. Recently, on June 25th, 2009, the Monroe, Michigan Evening News featured a story entitled End of an Era that announced public hearings on the plans for the termination for the license for the Fermi 1 nuclear power plant. This was the beginning of the end of a very long and troubled history of this reactor that had been built, started to be built in the late 1950s in Laguna Beach. That's what it was called, Laguna Beach, Michigan, less than 30 miles south of Detroit. This plant was the first of its kind in the nation, a quasi-private, plutonium-producing, sodium-cooled breeder reactor. And it was to be a showcase for the U.S. of U.S. scientific progress and a harbinger of more public nuclear power plants. There was almost universal support for the project among politicians, citizens, and scientists. It was seen as a part of a larger program to develop the peaceful uses of atomic energy. After a groundbreaking in 1956, the plant went online in 1963, delayed because of technical problems. These setbacks associated with the experimental nature of the technology were not the only problems that Detroit Edison and the consortium of companies dedicated to building the plant encountered. There was one constituency that attempted to thwart the building and operation of this plant: organized labor. A handful of local unions and their national organizations pressed for greater accountability regarding the process by which this plant was approved for construction, greater transparency regarding the funding arrangements, greater accessibility of scientific data to determine the safety of the plant. Through hearings before the Atomic Energy Commission and ultimately a case before the United States Supreme Court, labor unions tried to stop the building and operation of this plant. Their concerns, turns out, were justified. In October of 1966, a decade after the project had begun, Fermi One suffered a critical event, an accident that rendered the facility impaired for the rest of its life.
What year was that?
1966, October 5th, 1966. We will return to that. Not until 1975, however, when the journalist John Fuller wrote "We Almost Lost Detroit," describing these events, did the public become fully aware of the dangers that they had been living through. And then in 1977, Gil Scott-Heron, the late, great Gil Scott-Heron, wrote a song. Oh, I knew this was going to happen. Here. Why am I not doing this right? Okay, so Gil Scott-Heron wrote a song describing the events, and I'll leave this up for a little bit so you can read it. The song is long, and we would have definitely gotten very involved in it, and it would have been a very hard act for me to follow, so I haven't brought the recording with me, but you can find it easy enough. He recently passed away, and even some of his most recent concerts, he was doing this song, so it was obviously part of his repertoire. The story of the Fermi Atomic Power Plant and the unions will be one chapter of a monograph that I'm working on, which I'm tentatively calling Working in Place: Working Class Consciousness, Culture, and Resistance in Downriver Detroit. Each chapter will consider different ways in which workers forged and understood their relationship to place and enacted their rights to and over land. Labor historians do not usually address this directly. They look to skill, ethnicity, gender, race, nationalism, political ideology, and religion to understand the sources of class consciousness or class division. Place, space, and land have made an appearance in the scholarship as merely settings for, but not sources of, identity, agency, or resistance. Geographers who consider labor and working class do theorize about the importance of place and working class experience. One, for example, who I've been collaborating with recently, Andrew Herod, suggests that, quote, "Whilst it is widely accepted that workers make their own histories, though not under the conditions of their own choosing, we must recognize that they make their geographies, though likewise not under the conditions of their own choosing." And in a recent article in the radical geographer's journal Antipode, geographer Allison Stennen reported that working classness is placed. It is performed and constructed within communities and in turn shapes the spaces of community, economy, politics, and much more. So in this project, I will be exploring how for the working class, in this larger project of which this is a part, I will be exploring how for the working class, place is a source of identity, a site of consciousness creation, and a reason, rationale, as well as a setting for agency and resistance. And I'm going to have different case studies related to this, and the Fermi story that I'll be telling you today is just one of those. So I obviously decided upon using the Downriver Detroit region as the place, the site that I was going to explore this in. And I found it a very worthy one. For some of you who may not know, I've been working on an article and soon will be publishing an article on Point Mouillet, which is a duck hunting refuge, literally 5 miles from this atomic power plant. And it is actually in doing the research on that duck hunting site, which working class people wanted to keep as a public site, that I became for the first time aware of this power plant in the first place. So it is through a lot of the times Google Earth explorations of this setting that I become aware of some of these stories. So Downriver Detroit, I thought, was a really important place to explore along these lines. Starting in the 19th century, industry found the coast of the Detroit River south of the city of Detroit a convenient and productive site. Over the course of the 20th century, hundreds of manufacturing establishments in auto, steel, chemical, paper, and energy came and left the region. Throughout the 20th century, hundreds of thousands of workers from the South, United States South, Detroit, and other points in Michigan arrived in the region to find employment. By the mid-20th century, it was a site for deindustrialization, and this left pollution to a very large extent in its wake. These historical developments, which will comprise other chapters of the book, not only forged an industrial region, but also a regional identity rooted in ethnic racial background of the workers and the relationship to the places they lived, worked, and played. One of the things that's been really interesting in exploring this regional identity is the persistence of an identity around the early French explorers in the Detroit region, which is always very surprising when I go down there. A lot of French names, a lot of orientation around that early French explorer heritage there. So the unions that are involved in this story, and here, let me show you this, if I can get it to work. John. Oh. No, that's not it either. That's what I was doing.
Okay, no, it's right here.
Oh, sorry. Okay. So this is actually not Fermi 1. This is Fermi 2, which was built in the 70s. And this is a picture of it from the swamp that I was just telling you about, from Point Mouillé. So it's kind of a striking photo of it. Okay, so the unions that are involved in this story are the United Automobile Workers Union, the International Union of Electrical Workers, and the Paper Workers Union. Became involved in this fight against Fermi to safeguard the health and safety of the places their working class members lived and worked. They were not motivated to protect the health and safety of the workers building or working in the plant, although they probably wouldn't have ignored that fight. But they themselves were not there. They were defending those workers who lived and worked in the region. They were protecting place, not simply workplace. By engaging in these activities, they claimed a right to determine the future of their place, the Downriver Detroit region. They claimed a right to say no to a dangerous nuclear power plant in their backyards and on the banks of their rivers and lakes. This was not nascent environmentalism or an early version of the No Nukes movement, although some in the story will go on to do this later as a result of their participation in this struggle. In the mid-1950s, when this story starts, there are no grassroots anti-nuclear groups, concerned scientists, or local citizens working to the halting of this plant. Right? And they will do that, however, during the creation of Fermi 2. In 1956, there was just the unions, and their objections revealed class conflict over the use of space in Laguna Beach, Michigan. The workers represented by these unions challenged the choice between jobs and a clean environment, as Don was saying earlier. They articulated place-based rights that asserted that the safety of the environment ensured the ongoing development of industry and jobs and their futures. What these unions did was really remarkable. When I first discovered this, it was not consistent with anything that I had ever learned about labor history and the relationship between working class people and the environment. It was completely different. Their efforts to stop Fermi not only undermined their economic self-interest by working against the building of a power plant that was supposed to bring jobs and economic development to the region, but also they did this in the context of the Cold War, when challenging U.S. nuclear superiority could be seen as potentially treasonous. In my longer article, I have a very long discussion of the literature that exists about this plant and the early years of the Atomic Energy Commission, and I'm going to be presenting a very sheared-down version of this, all right? But there's a lot more to it. Histories of the building of Fermi 1 have not considered the objections of unions in this way. Most scholarship is one-sided and politically informed. Public histories of the Atomic Energy Commission are well-crafted history, but they provide an in-depth narrative of a very complicated regulatory process and the lessons that could be learned by other government agencies as a result. John Fuller's account, We Almost Lost Detroit, and others to follow after Three Mile Island present the story as a cautionary tale regarding the inherent dangers of nuclear power. So they're clearly anti-nuclear power stories that use this as a part of that larger narrative. Historians of the labor movement are silent about the activities of workers and labor organizations regarding the development of nuclear energy during this period. Scholarship that considers these activities provide two related explanations for the behaviors of the unions regarding the construction and operation of the plant, either an anachronistic analysis representing these efforts as precursors for what will be full-blown environmental activism later. So weren't these unions so smart? There were no nuke before there was no nuke, which is not correct. Or as social unionism consistent with Walter Ruther's UAW liberal labor Cold War policies, projecting back onto the late 1950s and early 60s, what would be consistent and true later, since the UAW, of course, was very instrumental in supporting and promoting Earth Day and other environmental things in the 1970s. So these were all very unsatisfying explanations. And I have to add here that there is one historical work, that does deal with the participation of the UAW and the UAW alone in this series of events. And it was a senior honors thesis that was written in the 1980s by a Harvard student undergrad. Unfortunately, it is on deposit in the Bentley Library in Michigan, so I was able to read it. And he did some interesting interviews of Walker Sisler and some other people involved, so I was able to use that, although his view is only of the one union, and it's didn't have the access to some of the archives that I did in order to answer the questions of the story. So there is one account, but it's limited, and it was done by a very smart undergraduate at Harvard. Okay. So there's a lot of acronyms and groups and government procedures and all the like, so hopefully this will be helpful, all right, as I begin the story of what went on. Fermi 1 was built in Downriver, Detroit, by Detroit Edison and Walker Sisler, its head, to explore the possibilities of the peaceful uses of the atom, an effort that was unleashed by the Atomic Energy Commission and the Atomic Energy Act of 1954. The Atomic Energy Act of 1946 established the control of atomic energy in the hands of a newly created AEC, Atomic Energy Commission, with oversight by the Joint Congressional Committee on Atomic Energy. While the commission's major duties involved the military uses of the atom, there were provisions for the development of atomic energy, including, quote, a total monopoly in atomic energy development, directing basic research, development, production of fissionable materials, and authority to inspect and license facilities using these fissionable materials. Starting in the early 1950s, though, there was interest in some industrial quarters for some opportunities for private industry to explore the development of nuclear power. The presidents of Detroit Edison, successfully, a couple of them in succession, were involved from the very beginning. In 1951, Detroit Edison had joined with Dow Chemical of Midland, Michigan, to propose the creation of a plant to create fuel for power plants and weapons production. Sisler, and I think I have a picture of him here. Oh, that's Fermi 1. That's what it looked like. So it's not those big spouts, but it looked like this. And this was that round thing was probably the most iconic part of the plan. It was the containment vessel. It was supposed to keep everybody safe. So there's Walker Sisler. He was a key player in lobbying for what would become the Atomic Energy Act of 1954, the legislation that opened the door to private industry to develop nuclear power plants. The AEC began a power reactor demonstration program, soliciting proposals from companies and consortiums desiring to build large plants. These multiple rounds of solicitations in the 1960s, according to one scholar, and this is actually really important, quote, marked the consolidation of the government-industry partnership in nuclear energy development. The Detroit Edison Group, and Dow Chemical had dropped out by this point, was one of the three original proposals approved by the AEC. This consortium of companies proposed to build a fast breeder reactor at a site owned by Detroit Edison in Laguna Beach, Michigan, just north of Monroe. This consortium, and there was dozens of companies that joined with Detroit Edison to bring the plant into existence. This consortium of dozens of companies was supported by two nonprofit shadow companies. The Fermi plant is sometimes called Detroit Edison, but it's also sometimes referred to as the PRDC plant. And that stands for the Power Reactor Development Company. PRDC was its official parent company. It oversaw the construction, logistics, and on-the-ground activities. The APDA, the Atomic Power Development Associates, which was created just a few months before the PRDC, provided research and scientific support. The former manager of the APDA for most of Fermi's existence wrote that these two organizations would function as companion organizations, with PRDC building, owning, and operating the reactor, and the APDA providing much of the supporting engineering, research, and development work. Walker Sisler created, staffed, and headed up all three, Detroit Edison, the PDRC, and the APDA. He was the father of Fermi. The type of reactor that Sisler and his groups had chosen to build, a fast... Oh, and I shouldn't... Here, let me go forward here, show you this. These were all of the companies associated with the PRDC. And so it's a huge consortium of power companies. And these are the Atomic Power Development Associate Member Companies again. They were nonprofit, so they did not have to pay taxes on the earnings that they made. Okay. Oh, and here. This, I just like this because of the design. And that's obviously an idealized version of Fermi there. Okay. The type of reactor that Sisler and his groups had chosen to build, a fast breeder reactor, required research and development because it was such a new and untested technology. Work that had been originally done in the Manhattan Project suggested the possibility, and here I'm definitely on very shaky ground since I don't know anything about the physics here, but it suggested the possibility of a breeder reactor, a reactor that could breed more fissionable material than it consumed while producing heat for power. By the time the PRDC was negotiating with the Atomic Energy Commission for a license to build Fermi, scientists were already aware of the dangers of these fast breeder reactors. November 1955, there was a partial meltdown of the core at the experimental breeder reactor number one, developed and operated by Argonne at AEC's Idaho test facility, and there would be others to follow. The PRDC also proposed to use liquid sodium as a coolant in the reactor. Liquid sodium is a very dangerous substance that explodes violently when it comes in contact with air or water. Experts from the late 1950s and scholars today concur that during this early period of the development of nuclear power, it was expensive relative to the abundant supply of other sources, there was very little demand for it, and that the competitive commercial use of it, because of these difficulties in the technology, was at least 10 years in the future. So then you have to ask yourself, why was there this push to build this plant at this place at this time? There seems to be three reasons. First, there was considerable concern expressed by the public, politicians, and scientists that the United States was losing its place as a leader in atomic sciences. This was certainly a general concern during the Cold War, but there were many specifically concerned that the U.S. was not just falling behind the Soviet Union, and I found this very interesting in the research that I did, but also England and Canada in the quest to develop peaceful uses of atomic power. Those who participated in all these efforts to develop Fermi 1 saw it as an ongoing experiment necessary to retain our leadership position in nuclear sciences and technology. Walter Sisler described this as a patriotic as well as an economic endeavor. Second, developing the fast breeder reactor would significantly change the economic viability of nuclear power, supporting both growth at home and abroad. And there was a big push to develop this and partner with foreign nations in the development of this, including... Interestingly enough, there's a lot of partnership with Japan at this time. Third, the enriched plutonium created by the breeder reactor would be sold back to the government, not just for use in other reactors, but also for nuclear weapons. Hans Bethe, the Cornell University nuclear physicist and a Detroit Edison consultant during this time, reviewed how the breeder reactor would, quote, make more fuel than was put into it, and the fuel which it produced would have real value. The excess fuel could be made into metal bars and sold for military purposes or for use and utilization or converter-type reactors. In January 1956, after experimentation and analysis of data from other reactors, the PRDC filed for a construction permit with the AEC to build the Fermi plant. Within the AEC, various subcommittees met and hearings were held. There were public hearings. There were no public hearings or disclosures of any kind, although the Joint Congressional Committee on Atomic Energy was kept apprised of the progress of the plant. Let me go back to these. In June of 1956, the AEC's Advisory Committee on Reactor Safeguards, right here, issued its report that contained the now infamous line, and I'm warning you, there's a lot of double negatives in here, but I think you'll get the gist of it. Even though there are no facts or calculations available to the committee that clearly indicate that the proposed reactor is not safe, the committee believes that there is insufficient information available at this time to give assurance that the PRDC reactor can be operated at this site without public hazard. So it's the last phrase that's important. The committee believes that there is insufficient information available at this time to give assurance that the PRDC reactor can be operated on this site without public hazard. This reflected divisions within the AEC about these kinds of projects, about public-private investments, about insurance and oversight, a lot about insurance. I'm not even going to go there in this paper, but how you insure something like this and who's responsible for that was a huge subject of debate during this in a lot of the records. About location and siting of experimental reactors and many other issues. But the director of the AEC, Admiral Lewis Straws, too cheap to meter Straws. He's famous for that line, that nuclear power, if developed, would be too cheap to meter. I'm sorry, I couldn't resist. And the head of the PRDC in Detroit, Edison, Walker Sisler, had already decided on a day for the groundbreaking ceremony for the plant, August 8, 1956. Only 4 days after the construction permit had been issued. They went ahead with these plans, inviting dignitaries to the event as they suppressed the negative information in that safeguard committee's report. When the members of the Joint Committee on Atomic Energy became aware of these events, its chair, Senator Clinton Anderson, of New Mexico, began to alert interested parties about this development. This is when the labor unions become involved in efforts to stop the construction and the operation of Fermi. Even though it's not entirely clear who called whom, it's probably Senator Anderson who informed either Walter Reuther or Leo Goodman, Walter Reuther's expert on all things atomic in the UAW. On July 16th, Senator Anderson informed an already concerned Governor Williams of the existence of this worrisome report. And one of the things you should notice is that there's not much about the state of Michigan in here. Because Williams, while he did have a committee to investigate the safety of nuclear power at this time, was very tepid in either supporting it or objecting to it. So they stayed very neutral throughout most of these proceedings. Senator Anderson, an environmentalist whose state had hosted the Manhattan Project, had helped Reuther get appointed to the President Eisenhower's Blue Ribbon Committee on the Peaceful Uses of Atomic Energy in 1955. Clinton Anderson also hated Lewis Straws, because Anderson, a Democrat, believed that Lewis Straws had politicized the AEC in ways that his predecessor had not. To Anderson, the early groundbreaking at Fermi was in the service to the re-election of Eisenhower, ignoring science and safety. By late August 1956, Walter Reuther and the three local labor unions had filed with the AEC requesting a hearing on the plant. The involvement of the unions was not their introduction to nuclear politics. And this is where labor history is completely and utterly silent, as far as I could tell. Rather, it was the result of the interest and concern of these international unions that dates back to the 1940s. Reuther's participation on the committee exploring the peaceful uses of atomic energy, and that's the cover page of his report, from his participation in that, reflected ongoing policy development and lobbying by labor unions in Washington, D.C. on this issue. Both the AFL and the CIO, before the merger process started, had committees and technical and legislative experts on the field ready to promote their positions and weigh in on matters of importance to their members. Throughout the 1950s, the AFL's Andrew Miller, I think it's how it's pronounced, frequently testified regarding labor's interests before the Joint Committee on Atomic Energy, and he continued to do so as the AFL-CIO's legislative representative. Even though these two organizations had very different emphases, they were able to come together to articulate a unified labor policy. The AFL-CIO supported, now, and it's important that you realize that this is not an anti-nuclear policy, right? The AFL-CIO supported a quick and vigorous development of nuclear energy as both a Cold War and economic policy. They believed that this should be undertaken as a joint public-private venture with no monopoly in either sector of the economy. And because of the newness of the science, there was a great deal of concern over the health and safety of the workers in all of the industries that used anything nuclear. any nuclear materials. And there were a lot of industries that were starting to use it, not just to build plants or weapons, but also in the pursuit of a whole host of industrial pursuits. And labor argued for rigid standards and federal government oversight and regulation of workplace safety, as well as workers' compensation for those injured through exposures to these materials. While representing the AFL in 1955, B. Miller stated that, quote, private industry should be permitted and encouraged to become active as rapidly as is consistent with the goal of genuine competition and as rapidly as it demonstrates a willingness and ability to assume reasonable risk and responsibility. Perhaps the most passionate union expert working in the atomic energy field was Leo Goodman. There's about 250 boxes of his materials at the Library of Congress archives. He was a career union man, born in 1910 in Boston. He took several years of coursework in science at MIT and then economics at Harvard. And starting in 1934, he moved to Washington, D.C. To work in the National Recovery Administration and then a variety of union positions in the national offices there. He worked in as the research director for the shoe workers, as the Washington representative for the United Retail and Wholesale Department Store Workers of America, CIO, as the secretary of the CIO's Cost of Living Committee during World War II, and as the secretary of the CIO's National Housing Committee after World War II. In 1954, he's the secretary of the CIO's Committee on Atomic Energy, Power, and Natural Resources. And this is when he starts his several decades crusade regarding atomic energy. And I don't have a really nice picture of him, but this is at least one of the obituaries that appeared about him in 1982 when he died. He was involved, I'm just going to summarize this really quickly. He was involved in nuclear activities for two reasons. One, he was appalled by the story of the Radium Girls, which some of you may be aware of, these girls in the 20s who worked painting radium on the dials of clocks, and you would frequently lick the brushes, and they died of mouth cancer as a result of it, so that appalled him in terms of, as a worker safety issue. And also, when he was working for the CIO Housing Commission, he was put in charge of the housing issues in Oak Ridge, Tennessee, which is a huge nuclear facility. Not only did workers suffer from radiation sickness there, but they had no recourse regarding their living conditions in what was essentially a town run by the AEC. This becomes Goodman's lifelong vocation. And he served on a number of expert technical committees. He was on that panel for the peaceful uses of atomic energy on the labor committee for them. And he was also sent to Brussels to participate in the Confederation of Free Trade Unions conference on the peaceful uses of atomic energy. So he was the go-to man for all of these sorts of things around the nation and the world. After his participation in the Fermi affair, he began collecting information on nuclear industrial accidents throughout the world. And when you look through his records, there are just file cards of these, hundreds and hundreds, thousands of them, actually. And when John Fuller set to do the research on the Fermi plant and its accident, one of the people that he contacted and spent a great deal of time with was Leo Goodman. So he's really the expert on this. Goodman was perhaps the most passionate and most committed national-level activist with the unions. He worked very closely with Ben Segal, who worked as the general counsel for the International Electrical Workers Union. And I'll just mention that really quickly again to move it forward. He was in the official employ of the Electrical Workers Union, but he was the lawyer, the general counsel, who pursued these suits through the AEC and then ultimately to the Supreme Court. So he was the legal point person for these cases. So within 3 weeks after the AEC approval of and groundbreaking at Fermi in early August 1956, the unions filed for a hearing to stop further progress on the construction of the Fermi plant. The legal issues were pretty straightforward, and the chronology has been covered a lot in a lot of other sources. The three unions, the interveners, as they were called, requested public hearings at the AEC on the construction of the construction permit for the Fermi plant, and these hearings began in January of 1957. There were four major issues: concern over public safety, financial viability of the project, indemnity and insurance issues, and the fact that the AEC had violated the Atomic Energy Act of 1954. By not conducting public hearings about the operation of the plant. Critics of the AEC objected to the dual and the potentially conflicting goals of the commission to both promote and to regulate nuclear power, which is what they were charged to do. The secrecy regarding the safety report as well as the timing of the groundbreaking suggested to some that the regulation had taken a back seat to promotion. The 2 years of hearing before the AEC brought forth many scientists, experts, and lawyers to testify, and in the end, not surprisingly, the AEC supported its original decision to issue the construction permit. And when you go through the records, it is one scientific report after another. It's just very voluminous in the kind of work that they did. They subjected the plant to a schedule of safety and financial reviews for the future, and they claimed that there was no threat to the public because the AEC had only issued a construction permit. When the PRDC was ready, they would have to apply for an operating permit, and by then the AEC was convinced that all the potential problems would be resolved. The interveners, however, were concerned about what they referred to as the economic factor. After committing an estimated $50 million on the construction and research, how likely would it be that an operating permit would be denied? In July of 1959, the interveners petitioned the U.S. Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia to set aside the decision of the AEC, and a year later they prevailed. A majority of the judges ruled that safety needed to be determined for the construction stage as well, and that the AEC had not presented compelling reasons why such a large power plant needed to be built in such a densely populated area. Nevertheless, and defying logic, the Court of Appeals granted the PRDC permission to continue construction and research because the AEC was taking the case to the Supreme Court. On June 12, 1961, in a 7-2 decision, the Supreme Court reversed the appeals court decision. And even though this was the official go-ahead for the building of the plant, there had actually been no delay in the construction or the research. Throughout early 1960s, the interveners persisted. Whenever there was construction or technical delays or additional fundings requested, clearance needed to use restricted materials, the interveners would weigh in with their objections and make a general nuisance of themselves. And that's how they were certainly perceived. So why did they do this? What was motivating their persistent objections to this plant? Part of it was clearly Leo Goodman's emerging sort of anti-nuclear stance. But the participation of the local unions and the demographics of support and resistance are also significant. Overlooked in the story are the local unions and the range of oppositions that did exist to the construction and the operation of the plant. These objections have been overlooked, and the representation of the objections have been distorted. There seems to be two reasons why. First, the media repeatedly asserted, and this will be familiar to us today, that those objecting to the plant were not motivated by safety at all, but by the public-private issue. Those opposing the plant were called socialists, thereby discrediting them during this Cold War period. John Grimes of the Wall Street Journal, hardly surprising, I suppose, began his op-ed piece by asserting that in the AEC hearings, the real issue is whether the federal government or private business should have primary responsibility for developing electricity from the atom. In the Detroit Free Press, quote, the opposition is found among those who lean towards a socializing of the nation's energy resources, and they are raising the bugaboo of grave risks as a weapon against the evolution of atomic power in the hands of private enterprise. And even the Monroe Evening News, the local paper, chimed in that the plant is merely a pawn in the public versus private power fight between those who want private industry to remain supreme in the public field, the power field, and those who want the federal government to have charge of electric power development. Okay, so that's the first reason. The second reason is that Detroit Edison mounted a very vigorous and successful public relations campaign to stifle local opposition. Sisler spoke to the Monroe Businessmen's Association at the Monroe Golf and Country Club, and again, I have quotes to demonstrate this, but I'm going to move forward, to mollify their fears about any sort of, you know, public safety issues. Detroit Edison also hosted a number of successful open houses where they invited dignitaries and the public to view the plant. And in 1957, they opened up an information center with exhibits, which was oriented to school visits. And they had a nice little brochure. This is a guy with an atomic ray gun. So they really participated in this effort. And there was like 72,000 people that visited it. There was a real effort to sort of domesticate the atom and to make this seem like a very benign and friendly type of technology. Atomic Energy, and this was successful. Between 1956 and 57, the Atomic Energy Commission will receive letters of support for the plant's construction from the Monroe Businessmen's Association, the North Dixie Business and Professional Men's Association, the Eastside Businessmen's Association of Monroe, and I've got about a dozen more here. All right, so all of the major businessmen and civic associations wrote to the AEC saying, we're happy to have this plant in our backyard. So even though Sisler may have succeeded in mollifying the country club set, this was not the case with the unions that I described at the beginning. Even though the original impetus to request the hearing before the AEC and the courts must have come from the international unions, the interveners that technically were local unions. And as local unions of the UAW, the UPW, and the IEU, they filed separately, and they gave specific reasons for their actions. There were five United Paper Workers unions, Local 999, 1000, 1003, 1004, and 1006, representing almost 1,750 workers. There was one UAW local, 878, with over 1,000 members, and then one IUE local, 945 of Detroit, where I don't have membership numbers. Monroe was a community of about 21,000 citizens during the 1950s, so this was about 3,000 workers and their families who objected to this plant. In their initial filings for a hearing before the AEC, these unions articulated their rationales very clearly. There was some overlap in the language of the petition, suggesting some national coordination, but the arguments are local and place-based. All identified the potential danger of the plant to all nearby, the 1,849,000 residents of Detroit and the 300,000 residents of Toledo, both about 30 miles away, as the major reason. They objected to the lack of any public hearings and secrecy regarding the process, alleging that the AEC was violating the Atomic Energy Act. These local interveners were very concerned and very specific about the potential loss of livelihood, the compromising of their property rights, and access to natural resources resulting from an accident. The IUE petitioned that its members owned real estate and other property in the area worth in excess of $10 million. An explosion, they continued, quote, would imperil and destroy the property rights of IUE and its members in collective bargaining agreements with employers in said areas, end of quote. The UAW made a similar argument that union members owned real estate and other property in the area worth in excess of $500 million and that, quote, the UAW owns real estate and other property, including its international headquarters, in excess of $2 million and that the UAW Local 12 operates a summer camp for boys and girls at Sand Lake, Michigan, 40 miles from the plant. But it was the paper workers that were the most impassioned. John's proud of that. In addition to asserting that an accident at the plant would imperil and destroy the health, lives, homes, property rights, and collective bargaining rights of the workers and their families, they also claimed that an explosion would, quote, depress the value of real estate and other property owned by workers, an accident would imperil and destroy the establishments in which they worked, and that companies would leave the area, end of quote. Finally, they asserted that an accident would contaminate the water supply in the city of Monroe, endangering the health of its citizens and disabling the paper industry through a destruction of its essential water resource. Because of the importance of water for the papermaking process, this was a unique concern of the papermakers, and it reappears in their journal, and not only local, but in their national journals. And you have to, I think it's important to add here that they didn't object to this because they wanted to keep water pure and free of pollution. Because as Bill Connor, the local labor leader down in Monroe area, told me, paper making is one of the most polluting processes. So they wanted the water to be clean for them to pollute, right? So it wasn't an environmentalism but in a way that we understand it. So they just didn't want it to compromise their efforts at using the water in their own way. Despite contemporaneous and historical accounts to the contrary, the local workers weren't the only ones concerned that this potentially dangerous nuclear power plant would compromise their health, jobs, property values, and environment. And this is another part of the distortion of the record, because there were others besides the unions that were against this. There were objections to the siting of this dangerous plant from those up and downwind as well. And not for the obvious reasons, but also because these constituencies saw that they had no say in the matter whatsoever. Two congressmen from the Detroit area, a newly elected Charles Diggs, the first African-American to serve from Michigan, and John Lisinski, Jr., as well as two congressmen from Ohio, one from the Cleveland area and one from Toledo, registered their concerns for the citizens that they represented in the their environments. The National Farmers Union proclaimed that the plant was a threat to agriculture in the region and requested more study on the effects of an accident on farming and the land. Wallace Campbell, the director of the Cooperative League of the United States, expressed concerns for the thousands of their members in the region and a $6 million headquarter building in Columbus, Ohio, should there be an accident. The only municipalities to officially object, however, were located across the Detroit River. The mayor of Amherstburg and the Reeves of Malden and Anderton townships in Ontario issued a statement requesting that the building of the plant cease until it could be certified as safe. The Windsor City Council followed suit, and the director of the Canadian Region No. 7 of the UAW, George Burt, stated that because of weather conditions, the people of the Windsor-Amherstburg area, quote, have more reason and a greater right than even the people of Detroit-Toledo to be concerned about what this, to be concerned about what he called this Monroe Laboratory. And the UAW locals across the border in Canada also objected, I should probably add. Since this regional place-based opposition did not appear in the media reporting of these events, and because these constituencies did not join the interveners, their objections have pretty much been lost to history. There's no question, however, that many in the regions contiguous to the plant had serious unanswered concerns about the siting of this plant, and these concerns will grow. And I'm going to share with you, in conclusion, I'm almost done, a really horrific event that alerted the locals in their area to the dangers of the plant in a very immediate way. As technical problems delayed the plant's operation, many became increasingly aware of how much of an experiment this reactor really was. And it began to dawn on many that the downriver region was Detroit Edison's laboratory and its citizens their experimental subjects. At 6:25 p.m. in a calm summer evening of July 11, 1958, an explosion occurred at a Detroit Edison research facility at the Sibley Quarry in Trenton, Michigan, which is about 15 miles north of Fermi. The quarry was where the Atomic Power Development Associates, the research arm of the Fermi project, conducted its tests on liquid sodium, the coolant for the Fermi plant. Tests and explosions that resulted from them had been occurring since 1955, but on this summer evening, as a result of a test, an area of Riverview, which is just north of the test site, was rained on by alkali fallout, burning a number of the residents, including children who had been playing outside, as well as cars and houses. According to the Michigan Attorney General's office, called in after the event, the explosions were simulated tests of this sodium coolant, and the researchers were determining the limits of components that would come into contact with the sodium coolant. However, quote, a sudden change in the weather at the time of the July 11th explosion resulted in blowing over of the cloud to Riverview. 48 people, many children, reported physical effects, including rashes and burns. 173 cars were damaged. 42 people reported property damage. All were apparently treated and compensated, but the association with the nuclear power plant clearly rattled the communities. According to the report of the Assistant Attorney General, some of the excitement arose from the fact that the people in the area thought that they had been subjected to atomic fallout. A homeowners organization was formed, and it was the specter of community opposition that prompted the Attorney General's office to protect the APDA and to enlist the company's official and the governor to provide reassurances that they were safeguarding public safety and compensating those who were injured. So after millions of dollars, delays, cost overrides, appeals and extensions, bad morale, there was a wildcat strike in the early 60s by the carpenters in the plant, and several minor accident incidents involving sodium, the Fermi nuclear power plant started critical operations on August 23rd, 1963. The unions tried to stop the go-ahead for operation, but in vain. In the summer of 1966, the 10th anniversary of the groundbreaking, an extremely critical article written by Saul Friedman appeared in the Detroit Free Press, proclaiming that, quote, there's a growing array of scientific and engineering opinion that Fermi has become little more than a gigantic radioactive white elephant. While Detroit Edison was mounting a public relations response to this, and right beforehand, Friedman's article will seem very prophetic. October 5th, 1966, Fermi experienced an accident, a meltdown of some of the fuel. And it was determined that there was no appreciable radiation escaping, but that individuals in the region and that individuals in the region were not in any danger. But the plant was very hot, and it took them a year and a half to figure out what had happened. Some of the metal had blocked coolant from circulating properly. They needed to wait for the section to cool down before going in and figuring out what had gone wrong. A Detroit Edison official, upon seeing the picture of a piece of metal taken with a special camera, said that it looked like a beer can. And so in the Detroit, I think it's the Detroit Free Press, or maybe it's the Detroit News, the headline is beer can, you know, cause of accident. And perhaps I suggest that this is the final swipe at the unions who had attempted to scuttle the project in the first place. But it turns out, of course, it wasn't a beer can. It was a metal object responsible. The metal object responsible for the accident, according to Fuller, was one of the five triangular pieces of zirconium that had been installed as an added safety measure to protect the upside-down cone-shaped flow guide. Somehow one of the five pieces had worked loose and clogged the coolant nozzles. It had first been installed back in 1959 and forgotten, and it wasn't even on the blueprints, which is why they had a hard time finding it after the accident. So I am just going to sum up here, just another minute. Even though the actions of organized labor on the local and national level failed to avert this disaster and could not prevent the wasteful spending of millions of dollars, we should neither ignore nor misrepresent their efforts. The union interveners were not nascent or proto-environmentalists. They were not trying to socialize public utilities in the United States. These actions cannot be explained as NIMBY, or not in my backyard movement. When the unions took up this cause, they did so as representatives of a larger working class constituency living, working, and playing in a particular place. And when the local unions petitioned to stop the construction and operation of this dangerous experimental atomic energy plant, they enacted their right to determine the health, safety, and economic viability of where they worked, lived, and played. These place-based objections have recently resurfaced. Detroit Edison, for those of you who don't know, is in the process of gaining clearance for building a Fermi 3 on the same site. There has been major objections and opposition from many environmental groups, but most recently, Occupy Toledo made an unexpected visit in December 2001 to the Nuclear Regulatory Commission hearings that were held in Monroe at the time. The representatives from Occupy Toledo denounced the gathering, quote, it's one of these down here, as nothing but a dog and pony show prioritizing the profits of Detroit Edison over the health and safety of the citizens of this region and the natural environment. So we'll all have to stay tuned and see what happens, and we'll see if they can do a better job than our courageous unions did. Thank you. Thank you.
Okay. Well, I've only got like 18 questions. So let me throw it out to you first. So, anybody have a question or a comment for Lisa?
Jim does.
Absolutely fascinating.
Thank you. Oh, yeah.
Are starting to really become a presence on the national.
Right, Women's Strike for Peace. Yep.
Women's Strike, yep, is really to take a lot of credit for messing up the House under
right
activities today. They're involved somewhat with the formation of the Committee for a
Sane Nuclear Energy, right. Right.
But I think you see the drift of my question.
Right.
About
I looked. I looked really hard for that. Mary Sinclair is obviously an important name. She's more involved in Midland. She is in touch with Leo Goodman, and her work is really a little bit later. I think somebody should, if not maybe me or somebody else, should do something on her. She's amazing. Yeah, she is. She lives in Pennsylvania. Yeah. So there's one, and I looked for local women's groups in the Monroe Downriver region, and they don't start really focusing on this. And there's even I don't know what the right word is. Rebecca, you'll have to help me. Where nuns live? A convent in Monroe. It was a very powerful anti-nuclear group of activists in the 70s. They'll come in later. In fact, a lot of people kept directing me to their papers, which is kind of interesting, and maybe I'll do something with that later, but not with this particular case. Leo Goodman was also involved with the Women Strike for Peace. They were in connection with each other, right? And I got a lot of interesting stuff about them in his materials, but nothing in connection specifically with Fermi. But I really did look. I looked. Garden Club record, anything I could possibly think of, but no.
We'll continue with the history department. Lewis?
So I'm concerned about consciousness here.
Mm-hmm.
And as I was listening to you, I started formulating something along the lines of something that at the very end of the conclusion you actually rejected.
Oh.
And that I was quite surprised to hear you reject.
And maybe I was wrong.
And it seems to me that other than Leo Goodman, the players here, the agents, are very strongly motivated by envy.
Yeah, you know, so I struggled with that. Yeah.
It's pretty evident that they don't want it here. They don't want it affecting them. And
but,
we shouldn't criticize.
So let me tell you what my thought processes was on that. NIMBY is usually associated with efforts by people who have power and influence and funds.
Exactly.
To put things like this in working class and minority neighborhoods,
right.
Which is not what's going on here. So that's why I rejected our usual thinking about NIMBY. Now, that these workers didn't want it in their backyard is absolutely true. But it isn't operating in the same way that you normally think about NIMBY. Like, I don't want to, you know, middle class people saying, I don't want a dump near where my children play, or I don't want, a recycling plant compromising my property values, that kind of thing. I mean, there are obviously echoes of that in some of the explanations that these working class people say, but they're not the elites. They're not the powerful here in determining where these things happen.
No, so essentially what you would then, the alternative way of putting this would be to argue for a democratization.
Of NIMBY. Okay, well, that's true. Yeah, that's interesting. All right.
Let me take one place that I hope that
rethinking
the evidentiary record, which is what's the role of the UAW, say, vis-a-vis the carpenters, vis-a-vis the, what's happening in the central labor bodies? What's happening in the Michigan AFL-CIO convention on this issue? What's George Meade doing as president of the...
Oh, I have things from him. He knows about this. Yeah.
And so, but
he's against it.
These guys are sitting side by side with the people who are building for me. And they're also sitting side by side in the state fed with the folks who are going to be operating this plant. So what kind of inter-union talk is there on all this?
I looked at the materials at the Meany Center, and there were the technical committee reports, environmental groups that the unions had. There seems to be partly because of Reuther, and his leadership in this. At least official rhetorical support for what's going on here, in terms of opposing the plant and for the reasons that were provided. I mean, they're walking a delicate line here because their official thing is to support quick development of nuclear power in the United States because for economic and, patriotic reasons, as I said. But on the other hand, they are objecting to this one in particular, and they're using the same sort of rhetoric that this is not the place to put it. It compromises the livelihoods and lives of individuals who are constituency, right? However, I did find a little evidence within the paper workers, actually, of disconnect between the locals and the national leadership. And apparently, the larger general leadership was more tentative in their opposition. They didn't want to be associated with this kind of objection. But Kerry blasts them a letter and says, we're all on the same page about this. We're against it. So I don't know whether that was reflective of a grassroots, that he heard from those local unions saying, you have to take on this cause for us, or whether it's a more horizontal, that the leadership in the unions were of one mind about how to one mind to object to this thing. I don't know that for sure. It's not revealed where the impetus for that comes from. But there is, there are hints that all of these unions are not unanimously or in the same way enthusiastic about this. Right.
What's the, so I came in a little late, sorry to address this.
White. White, right.
So, I mean, I wonder if they had, to what degree this conversion is called a defensive localism and this sort of homeowners' rights movement. And that starts a little bit before that. And I'm
right.
If these people were, they had developed this language of defending their home
yeah.
based on defending it against
anything compromising their property values, yeah. which they would have done against black people
yeah,
moving in as well. Right.
Yeah,
oh, that's interesting. Right, there's, yeah, there are, yeah, yeah. Yeah, yeah, but he doesn't use, like, the geography jargon that I use to justify
no,
that,
I
right?
I mean, it's a fascinating kind of way to think about it, but I'm just wondering if these people that might have developed the language that they use
yeah.
in the anti-nuclear campaigns through these campaigns based on race and all.
Yeah, there's, I have two responses to that. One is yes, I think there's definitely an element to that. There's echoes of that. The language is similar. The rhetoric is similar. The people are similar. A lot of them are migrants from Detroit,
right?
They're escaping, right? So yes, there's that. However, and this is something I'm going to explore in future chapters, this is a population that had a very high tolerance for environmental pollution. I mean, if you read accounts of what it was like to live in downriver during inversions, you know, I mean, it's as bad as the Midlands of England. It was just horrific. And so their tolerance was really high, I think. I mean, that's what I'm going to argue, for compromising their place, their setting, you know, their environment. And so I don't think that they would have mounted a knee-jerk reaction to anything that they saw was going to compromise their environment, because they were very used to it happening all the time. This was really unusual, right? This was, you know, they probably conjured up images of atomic, you know, mushroom clouds and the like. So this is different. This is on a different level than, you know, closing your windows on a bad night because the air smelled bad, right? So on the one hand, yes. On the other hand, again, I don't know if just that sort of knee-jerk reaction against something polluting is sufficient, right, as an explanation here. Does that make sense? Yeah. Yeah, Malcolm.
I guess my question is, I'm really fascinated by what you said about how people study the cities of Asia and the country, and then the next step would be for them to see themselves as being used as substitutes.
Yeah, yeah. Right. Yeah.
So I just wonder if there is some use of that metric to push that line of beauty, or even, you know, I think when we divide that lucky journal by these and was about fallout of the bikini experiment.
Right, well, that's what Women's Strike for Peace was all about, fallout, too, yeah. I mean, it's an emerging, but I think fairly small, you know, response in the 1950s and early 1960s. Specifically with respect to what's going on in Japan, I didn't see anything like that, but I have to admit I wasn't really looking for that as much. There's a lot of interaction, though, scientific exchanges that take place between Japan and Fermi, which, again, I didn't pay a lot of attention to that, but they're constantly inviting scientists from Japan and interacting with them.
I saw that there was a Tokyo Electric Company.
Mm-hmm. One of their, right. Yeah, I think so, yeah. And they, yeah, I mean, I could show, I didn't focus on it, so I'm not going to be able to speak very authoritatively right now, but I can certainly, I know where to look for it. I know exactly where it is in the materials. Yeah.
So,
yeah. Right. Okay, good.
Mike, way in back.
I'm sorry, I came in late and you've already addressed this in the part that I missed, and please don't try to do it now. I have a follow-up later.
Okay.
I heard you mention Midland, and I'm wondering if you could comment on why was it that the interveners in Mapleton were able to stop that plan, and what would it be that was different from those that were trying to intervene?
I don't know a lot about that. I think it was happened at a later date. Am I correct in that, in the Midland plant? Yeah, it was a little bit later. And so that, you know, I'm a historian. Context is everything. I mean, by the 1970s, it's a completely different terrain. And I'm not that, and that's the one that Mary Sinclair, who we were talking about before, was involved in, you know, trying to scuttle that effort. And I honestly don't know. But I do know that in the initial stages of Fermi, it was a joint enterprise. So at least in its genesis, right, the Midland plant might have been Fermi, right? I mean, they might have jointly made these together. That might have been sufficient for them. But I don't know anything about that particular story. I'm sorry.
Other questions? Sure.
I don't have a question so much as a comment. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Government's role either seems to be research or regulatory.
Mm-hmm.
And recently, as legislation caused government to consider itself as a safeguard to workers or environment, whatever. And the nation beginnings of this took place in times when political parties were at variance with one another. And I wonder what impact has that the 1950s and early 60s, the rule of government was heavily involved by the Cold War,
mm-hmm.
and the race to create patents for this thing, to ignore, to take bigger risks than they would have
mm-hmm.
in more modern times. And what effect do you think that would have on the research?
Whatever that might be. That question is probably one of the ones that animates most of the literature on this topic, right? The indemnity issue was a big one and brought lots of people interested. I mean, there were a lot of individuals who, when the government was called in to underwrite, you know, whatever the $100 million insurance policy that needed to be, you know, subsidized, went, wait a minute, that sounds dangerous, you know? So those were the sorts of questions, I think, that, and also the secretiveness, you know, of the early years of the AEC, the dual functions of regulation and, you know, support and promotion. That's what the bookcase that I have on this deals with. So I don't know how to answer. I mean, I think, obviously, most people see that this was a story with lots of missteps and faults that future regulators and promoters of certain types of new technologies should pay attention to, right? Because there was a lot of things that went wrong and a lot of things that weren't, partly because it was new, partly, you know, because political motivations weren't attended to. So I don't, you know, I can tell you specific things along the way that I learned in reading all of that, but I have to say, I tried much more to concentrate on what was going on the ground, right? I mean, for me, dealing with high-level technological regulatory politics is not my thing so much. Is there something specific about that you are curious about, or?
No, I was just really intrigued by the whole thing. I appreciate the chronology.
Yeah.
Because I didn't imagine other people here didn't know about that.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, I don't know. go ahead, Jim. I don't know. It's really at a very formative stage, and I was really going to use, you know, some of your suggestions to make it better. So I appreciate that.
May I go around the second day?
Sure.
You touched on the political topics. I'm thinking of Michigan State also. Mm-hmm. I think it would get a lot stronger and with more kind of contrast to it if you develop that quite a bit further.
Yeah, I took a lot of it out of this paper, actually. Yeah.
Because it's just as I think about this, I think the union and the working class opposition, if I can, you know, differentiate those two sides of it, will stand in even sharper contrast
mm-hmm.
when you look at the background of the state political context. There may be some very interesting dynamics here involving the Democratic Party. For one thing, it's kind of an interesting. fine and deep.
Yeah. On the other hand, the person that Leo Goodman hated the most was Williams, Governor Williams.
Yes.
Yeah, couldn't stand him because, not for partisan reasons, but because the state of Michigan did nothing, absolutely nothing. I mean, they had a commission. I've read all the materials out of that, the Williams papers down at the Bentley. And, you know, some of the members of the public health department expressed some concerns. But I think, you have to read between the lines a little bit, but I think he was just bowled over. First of all, he was kept out of the loop, which annoyed him no end, Williams, because nobody told him anything. He found out about that report after the fact. He wasn't informed at the beginning. The report on nuclear safeguards. Yeah, the one that stated that this was probably not a safe plant. He had to find out about that from other, it didn't come directly from the AEC to him. He had to find out about that from other sources. But even still, I mean, if you read between the lines, you think that there's enormous pressure to prove that the state of Michigan was a player in the development of this new technology, and that stifling it, scuttling it, was going to look bad on the national arena. I mean, that's the impression you get. The other thing that, I need to explore more, I have only done very little scratching the surface, is that, the whole weapons outcome from the production of plutonium, there's a lot of language about how much they were going to get for the plutonium that they were going to produce, and that the government was creating an artificially high price for it, and all of that. The city of Detroit is ringed by Nike missile silos during this time period. And so, the ways in which the Fermi plant is positioned in a context of, Cold War defenses, I have only begun to think about. I mean, I just became aware of it because that was one of the uses of somebody mentioned it was one of the uses of the plutonium. But in the Downriver region, there's, I think, at least two, if not more, Nike missile sites during this time period. So, from the perspective of maybe a Governor Williams, we have silos, we have missiles, we have nuclear power plants, whatever. They can all explode.
And a couple of major SAC bases at this time.
Yeah.
So
maybe it needs to be understood in that context as well, that what are we going to object to here? Yeah.
Well, let's thank you.
Okay, thank you.